Everyone I've spoken with in this series of interviews so far has said one thing to me, and that one thing is, you gotta talk to Doc Harris. On the other side of the microphone today is Doc Harris.
I didn't know so many people that you've talked to are certifiably insane.
I think you have to be in this business, don't you?
I suppose so.
Isn't that one of the qualifications?
Well, I'll tell you something. I have an article here. It comes from a British magazine called Word, and it was about John Peel and the death of rock radio and how it's become mechanized and corporatized and things like that. But there's a quote in the article that I loved. DJing has always been the natural job for people who can't do anything else but feel they're probably too good to actually do anything else.
Pretty much sums it up, but as I always say, and I guess you probably feel the same way, I've never worked a day in my life.
Well, that's the thing. My attitude is it's not that I feel I'm qualified to do anything else. I'm just too lazy to do anything else. It is one of the easiest jobs in the world if you like it, but any job is if you like it.
Right. We got lucky.
Yeah, that's right.
You started back in 1966. You must have been a pretty young lad at that time.
I started in 1963. I was a lot younger. I was about 13 at CFFM FM in Kamloops. Just one night a week doing the Saturday night dance show. And I didn't last long at that. I was only about 4 weeks. There was a guy working there as part of a recurring pattern in my career that didn't like me and got me out of there. What was ironic was the guy later showed up years and years later doing the all-night show on LG when I was doing mornings. And I never mentioned it to him. But it was...
Just give them that little smug grin in the hallway as you walk
by. I smiled to myself. Quietly slapped my knee.
So after you left your short little time in Kamloops, what was next on the agenda?
Went to CKDA in Victoria. Actually, went to CFMS in Victoria, but that was the FM for CKDA. And for reasons still unknown to me, they put me on the morning show, which I stuck with for, I think, about a year. But I was removed from that, too, because they felt that I didn't characterize the sort of attitude they wished to portray on the Sound of the Good Life.
So let me guess what you were playing at that time.
Okay, go ahead.
Frank Sinatra, Patti Page.
It was worse than that.
Oh.
We were playing instrumental versions of everything.
The Dying Strings.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. The not-so-mellow Crino Strings. Things like that. And they had classical programming at night, during which time several of us, we're all young guys because they didn't want to pay any money. I think I was making $235 a month. And what they did was some of the guys would accidentally put the classical sides on 45 instead of 33 and a third. And the whole thing would go by rather quickly. And it's like, but they didn't notice, because to them, it sounded the same. You know, it's like, pretty much, that sounds like classical music to me. Yeah, so I got fired out of there, and I think it basically came down to a thing where, among other offenses, I had played an instrumental track by Enoch Light of a song from The Sound of Music called The Lonely Goat Herd. And at the end of it said something like, if you ever sat next to a goat herd, you'd know why they're lonely. And they felt they didn't
fit in with the
classy image.
The tea and crumpets image that they were after.
Not at all. So I got canned out of there, but almost immediately I was hired by CKDA. Hart Kirsch was the program director, and he found me useful because, first of all, I would do the all-night show, which was a seven-hour job, 11 at night till 6 in the morning. And also I was a good dog's body because I could do production and I could help him out. I, in effect, became assistant PD. So I did that for a while, got fired, came back, got fired again. We had a comptroller there named Ruby Masters who did not like me one bit and swore every time I was on the air that I was playing rock and roll. I think it was just the way I presented it. But Golden Sound Radio had to get along without me. What I did find out to my chagrin and disgust later on was, during the time I had been there, George Davies, who was our consultant and was hooked up with a lot of very large and important and interesting pop music radio stations, had on several occasions told Hart that he wanted to hire me for some of them, one of them. And Hart always stopped him at that point. I never did hear about it till years later. He was blocking me.
He wanted to keep you where he had you.
That's right.
While you were playing this wonderful music
Yes.
and getting fired and rehired and Yes. fired and rehired, when did you finally decide it was time to get out of there?
Well, that would be the last time I got fired. And when I couldn't get another job, I went and tried at CJBI, and Ron Robinson pretty much gave me the boot. And then all of a sudden, I got a phone call from a guy I had worked with at CFMS who was up in Trail. And he was just leaving, but he said that they had an opening there. So I went up to CJAT, and they put me on. Obviously, they really needed me because they put me on two shifts. Yeah, I was on from 9 to noon and from 3 to 6.
And what year would that be?
That would be in 1969.
And you would be playing?
Pop music. Yeah, it was rock and roll.
Finally got into it.
Rock and roll. It was a little on the mild side. We weren't playing anything that was really kicking the doors off, but it's just the same. We were playing proper music. That was an interesting place because, once again, they had to draw from the talent pool they had in Trail. So we had things like a copywriter whose previous experience had been studying typing at Sprott Shaw. So her knowledge of how to write copy was somewhat limited. Also a little slow. Every evening about 5:30, we would have a thing sponsored by a car lot. She would bring in the copy just at the last second, so I had no chance to pre-read it. One evening, I had a live spot for the car dealer who seemed to be selling a car with a six-cycle interior and a 325 cubic foot engine. I'd pay to see that. Another one was a double feature, Prudence and The Pill. I swear, at the drive-in, Prudence and The Pill. Not Prudence and The Pill. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, that was an interesting time. So I was there for about 5 months, and then I got a phone call from another guy I'd worked with, this time at CKDA, a fellow named Dale Heath, who had recommended me to a new young neophyte program director named George Johns that they had working at CKOM in Saskatoon. So I flew out there to meet George, and the first thing is, this is in winter, first thing I was struck by was, as soon as I got off the plane, the cigarette I had behind my ear, which I had extinguished on landing, turned hard as a piece of chalk. And then I was led out to the parking lot where all the cars were plugged into things and the engines were running. It's like being on another planet, Mike. And so I also met George, who appeared to be an extremely rotund man, weighing about 350 pounds, until he took off the 9 jackets he was wearing. It was just amazing. Downstairs at CKOM's studios, there was a wall of ice on the window, which was floor to ceiling, that had to be a foot thick. I'm from BC, man. I had never seen anything like this. It was incredible. But CKOM was great because, first of all, George was on his first program director job, and he was determined to do something. He'd come from CKY, where he'd worked with Jimmy Darren and a lot of really great people like Chuck Dan and Gary Todd, Daryl B. So he was inspired, and he had hired a bunch of really great young guys to work there. Somehow, George has always had a real ear for talent, and he got some amazing people working there. People like Gary Russell, a guy named Woody Cooper, Gary Housley, who's back down in the States now, Ken Sebastian Singer, who ended up running CK in Regina. Who else? A whole bunch of people, anyway. A great roundup of folks. Put me on the morning show with Woody, which didn't work out at all, because we're both Leos, and essentially it was a fist fight for the mic. And also George would make me sabotage Woody by saying, say this to him. And the best one was, he says, just when he's right in the middle of something, Doc, what I need you to do is just say, I don't know, General Custer, they seemed friendly enough at the dance last night.
And he wouldn't have a comeback for that.
Who would? No. It's like another non sequitur prepared by a team of non sequiturs. So after that, I went to Sudbury, because George went to Sudbury, and he took me with him, and Woody. And so we went to Sudbury, Ontario, a remarkable town at the time. It's a lot nicer now, I'm told. But at the time, it was a hole in the ground with giant smokestacks spewing crap day and night, to the extent that they had pretty much killed off all the vegetation around the city. The actual guys who did the moon landing, the astronauts, came up and trained at a place called St. Anne of the Pines because it was so desolate, it was exactly like the moon. We had a guy named G. Michael Cranston doing the morning show. He'd been at Chum. He was an ex-Chum guy. And they had an FM also. But basically, it was kind of an amazing place, Sudbury, because it's like if you came out at night, my shift ended at 9 o'clock, if you came out at night and it was raining or just sort of misty, you could actually feel your face burning because it was sulfuric acid coming from the spew from the smokestacks mixing with the rain. Gary Russell came and joined us. He had been Eddie Russell at CKLW. Paul Drew, facing the Canadian content regulations, had had to hire Canadians. So among the others, he hired Gary, who was Eddie Russell at CKLW. And he came up, Gary, came and joined us at CKSL, and we became pretty tight. He ended up best man at my wedding, mm-hmm. but that was a lot of time later.
Still playing rock and pop at that
time?
Oh,
yeah, exactly, yeah, definitely.
Because a lot of stations had a lot of different things going on, including, as we used to call it, all over the road.
Yeah, well, before George came, they did. They had a country show, and they had a polka show, and they had a half hour of obituaries. But once again, great cast, great people. A guy named Bill Drake, Bill Pring, who had been a chum as a newsman. Quite a few people, anyway. Good, real pros.
And you stayed there until, says, about a year.
About a year, yeah.
And then headed south again.
Went to Hamilton.
Yeah.
Went to Cham in Hamilton. Yeah, that was an interesting experience, too. CKOC was the predominant pop radio station in the city. It was doing very well and had for a long time, and the young upstart Cham tried to apply a lot of top 40 principles that were basically American. I think, looking back on it later, and I didn't have this revelation until just a few days ago, they probably didn't connect with the people of Hamilton because they never localized. It could have been coming from anywhere. Mm-hmm. Sound familiar?
Yeah.
But it's like they were an early harbinger of it, and it was very slick. I mean, it's like we actually used stopwatches to back time the vocals. We'd sit there with I can still do this. It was like we didn't have digital counters because there was no digital. Ones and zeros had not yet been invented. And so we actually used stopwatches to time things. So it was a really tight little operation. And I started out on afternoon drive, and before long we switched to mornings. That was sort of up and down because these guys, despite their ability to deliver a really tight package, didn't really know what they were doing. It's like, I'm sorry to say, it's like it was a great cast of characters. There's some remarkable guys working there, but it's like it just never came off. But one day, Chuck Cameroo, the general manager, calls me into his office and says, they're looking for a program director at CFTR. I've left part of the story out. One of the reasons I left CKSO was because George Johns had moved on, and he had gone to CFRA in Ottawa to work for the Chum Group. He had been there for a number of years by now, and had gotten their QM up to the point where it was larger than the population of Ottawa, which is pretty impressive. So what happened was that Ted Rogers in Toronto had his changed CHFI AM to CFTR, and it was all over the road, and they were it was just not doing anything. So Chuck Cameroo says they need a program director for CFTR in Toronto. I said, well, I know a guy who's getting bored with what he's doing up in Ottawa right now. Why don't you call up George Johns or have Ted or Keith Dancy or whoever call him up and have a chat with him? George flew down, talked to them, flew back to Ottawa, packed his stuff, and moved to Toronto. Well, as a direct result of that, I got me a job in Toronto.
Changed your name, you became Doc Holliday.
Yeah, that was George's idea. It was either me or Russ Simpson was going to be Doc Holliday, and Russ didn't get the job.
You went there in 1971.
Yeah.
I went there in 1972. You were working at TR, I was working at Chum.
Right. And that's where I know you from. Yeah, okay, I was trying to figure that out.
Yeah, so we were basically across the street and deadly enemies.
Absolutely, and it was great.
Yeah.
I love radio wars.
The competition was amazing.
Do you remember our billboards?
Yes.
We had these billboards, which were stolen from a Todd Rundgren record ad, but it was still brilliant. They had these high contrast pictures of three of the DJs, Earl Mann, Chuck Christian, and Bob McAdory, holding sticks of dynamite, which were the only colored things in the... There were only two things colored on the billboard, which were the sticks of dynamite, bright red, and yellow flames coming off matches they were using to light the dynamite. And the cut line said, go ahead, try to ignore us. And it was just... And everything George did, because he had worked with Bob Wood before... being at CFRA, J. Robert Wood, the program director at Chum, was his main target. And everything he did was basically aimed at Bob Wood.
There were battles back then between the stations.
And some of the... It was interesting, too, because it's like Chum was very reactive. At one time, they actually got jingles that went CHUM at that time. And I thought, Oh, that's it. Drop your product. You know, it's like, never look behind you. And it's like, and they did. But, and it's like, so we had him for a while, but George once again moved on. He finally got his green card and went to work for Jimmy Darin down in Indianapolis. So they brought in Chuck Cameroon. Now, I'd already worked with Chuck for a year, so that was old news to me. And the fact was, Chuck did a few things that I thought were rather unsavory. One of them was to have a meeting with the whole air staff. Now, George had assembled a dream team at this radio station. He had Mike Marshall in the morning. He had Sandy Hoyt in middays. Earl Mann doing early afternoons. Earl is still doing lots of commercials. What a great voice. Chuck Christian in the afternoon. I was on from 6 to 9, and Sterling Fox did 9 to midnight. We had various people on the all-night show, including my operator, Rick Moranis. Rick Moranis ran the board. He had just dropped out of university, and he was working the controls for me. And he was brilliant to work with because he'd feed you all this stuff. His brain never stopped working.
Now, TR, that was probably the only station where you had an op.
I didn't start running my own board again until the last time around at Sea Isle. Yep,
they
true fact.
Operators for you here in Vancouver?
At LG. Moffat, getting a bit ahead of the story, but Moffat did a thing with us here where they said, we'll offer you a choice. We were, at the time, doing 6-day week, right? They said, you can have a 5-day week or you can have operators. And we all voted for the operators. It was not what they intended to have happen, but psyched them out. So what happened was, I was negotiating at the time because I didn't want to work for Chuck any longer. Oh, I never told you what the precipitating moment was. Chuck had the whole air staff into his office. I have a tape of this because he tape recorded it. I found the cassette years later. I don't know where it came from. But he says, everyone in this room, I want to stay. And by 6 o'clock that night, he fired 4 of them. So that gave me a pretty good idea of what we were in for. So I just, I started negotiating with LW to go to Windsor, Detroit. And that sort of was turning out flat. And then Gary Russell showed up at CKLG in Vancouver. Now, I'd been out here a number of times to visit my family and hung out at the station with Daryl B. and Frank Callahan and Hennessy and all those people. Really liked them. And you got to understand that one of the things I grew up on was LG. So it was sort of a desirable target. And when Jim Holt left to go to CFUN, which had just gone back on the air as CFUN with Chuck McCoy at the helm, Gary's brother, they had a hole in the afternoon drive. So they called me up and said, do you want to do it? Boy, would I. So I did my last shift on Halloween 1973 on TR and did my first shift on LG 3 to 6 p.m. on November 1st.
You didn't get fired from CFTR.
No, one of the rare times. I got out before they could get me. I haven't been fired every time.
Back to the left coast.
Yes.
And away from the snow and the cold and the ice and all the rest of that
you bet.
Crap.
Yeah.
And on to CKLG.
Doing afternoon drive, yeah, as Gil Harris. And the reason I became Doc Harris was simply that when I switched to mornings, and I'll tell you a story about that, when I switched to mornings, people were still calling me Doc because we had people like Gary and Sterling Fox working for us in Vancouver. They still knew me as Doc, and they just called me Doc all the time. So when I did switch to mornings, I took the Doc on. We needed a new identity anyway. What happened was, of course, the reason I got on mornings was because Roy Hennessy left the station to go do CFOX, and they needed a morning guy, and they decided it was me. Now, that was pretty simple.
You had fun there?
Oh, man.
You were there for a long time.
10 years.
That's a long time in radio.
It's a very long time in radio. Yeah, I had a great time there, man. We had, once again, we had a great air staff. We had wonderful people working there. Dan Williamson, Michael Morgan, a guy named Greg Collins, who went down to the States to become a writer, a screenwriter. Actually, got a couple of movies out. Well, Stu McAllister was doing news. The crazy man named Gordon Johnson was one of the newsmen. Callahan was the program director, one of the greatest guys I've ever worked for, the most easygoing cowpoke I've ever run into. You could come in with the goofiest idea, and as long as it was relatively inexpensive, he'd let you do it. It's like Ted Smith from WIC once said to me, we hire the best people for the job, and then we let them do the job. Yeah. Well, those are always the winners that do that. It's like, unfortunately, I've had to work for a number of people who are more into the line of, we really like what you do, now stop doing it.
Well,
I characterize you, listening to some of your air checks, you, to me, are very much like a Tom Rivers, the late Tom Rivers.
Tom worked out here, you know.
Yes, he did. Yeah. He's worked practically everywhere. But Tom was irreverent. He didn't take crap from anybody. And if somebody told him something that he didn't like, he would go out and do it, which is why he worked for Chum five times.
That's right.
Because he kept getting fired, and they kept rehiring him because they couldn't find anybody better. So you had the sort of same attitude.
Yeah.
You were irreverent. You did things that skated very close to the line, sometimes over the line, yeah. I understand.
Sometimes right into the abyss. And
CKLG must have been a lot of fun.
It was. We did great promotions. We had this thing called Bayman at one point. We rigged up this thing where we had the Adventures of Bayman. This was done with a guy named Denny Argue, who worked at the Bay and did their advertising. He later went down to the U.S. and did all the Gap advertising. Did very well with that. But Denny was a very creative guy, so he came up with the idea of Bayman. And we created Bayman in the flesh. We had two Baymen, actually. The idea was we'd go out in the Baymobile, and we'd park in front of your house and announce your location, and you had 73 seconds to come out and claim your prize. And they were great prizes, too, because they came from the Bay. I mean, these weren't cheap crap prizes by any means. But we had, some guy dressed as Bayman in the car. The DJs would drive the car, drive the Baymobile, and this guy would be in the car with you. Now, a lot of times, the saddest who put together the schedule would do things like having you do one cut in an hour for 3 hours after your shift. So I'm on in the evening between 6 and 9. One would be in Horseshoe Bay and the other would be in Surrey. So you'd have to drive like a bastard to get to Surrey. I got pulled over by the RCMP one afternoon. Here's this guy sitting beside me wearing a cape and a red and yellow outfit and a mask. The cop says, "Do you realize you were exceeding the speed limit back there, sir?" "But officer, this is Bayman." Apparently he wasn't too impressed.
He still got the ticket.
Yes, yeah. I did get the ticket. The other times we had a lot of time to kill during that hour because the places would be close together, so we'd have to find things to do. And we discovered that there was a railway crossing in Richmond that ramped up and ramped down. And we discovered that by getting the Baymobile up to a high rate of speed, we could make it fly.
And that's like the hump on the Gardner.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, same thing. So what was interesting was that eventually we got it to the point where it landed and the dashboard fell off into our laps. Oh, yeah, Gardner. Hey, you just reminded me of something else, too. When I was making the transition to CFTR, I was working at both radio stations. I was working in Hamilton during the week as Gil Harris and working as Doc Holliday on the weekends at CFTR and commuting back and forth on the QEW. It's like got a little confusing sometimes. It's like, but you know, the weirdest thing I ever did at CFTR was, you'd think, you know, I'd screw up, I'd say, you know, CHAM or something, but no. This is long before I worked for the place. I come out of a back cell and go, CKLG. Premonition. Foreshadowing. I have no idea. Anyway, yeah, what were some of the other highlights? I mean, the highlights at LG are innumerable. And we performed spectacularly. We actually had a larger queue than CKNW on a couple of occasions, which resulted in CKNW coming after me to try to hire me, because I was beating Frosty in certain quarter hours. And I know they didn't tolerate that. NW's policy always was what they couldn't beat, they bought. We performed remarkably well. We had a strike during that time. That was exciting because guys who stayed in made a lot of money working for both the AM and the FM. And also on the day of the strike, I was the first one. Because I lived in the West End, I was closest to the radio station. I was called up by, I think it was Gary called me up and said, "Go down and see what's going on." And I go down there and the building's surrounded by burly steelwork who in no way are going to let me enter the building. So we ended up doing it from a Fabco trailer at the transmitter site. A lot of interesting things happened out there because basically we had this little Fabco and it had a couple of turntables and a mic. And I remember, I think it was Sterling Fox, forgot to turn the mic off at some point. And there was stuff going on in the air that was quite spectacular. Interesting and colorful.
And you remained employed after that?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay.
No.
Usually when spectacular stuff goes on the air, that's...
Well, this was a strike, you see. This was...
You had them by the...
These were wartime conditions. Yeah. Just a million great things went on out at... The other thing at TR, and once again I go backwards, was we hired Buzz Bennett out of San Diego to consult the radio station. Actually, Cham hired Buzz Bennett to consult them. George Johnson, well, as long as he's around, why don't you have him come into Toronto? Well, Buzz ended up spending all his time in Toronto, and he tuned the station up to be sort of a clone of KCBQ, and that's how it got that sound. But it's like, Buzz Bennett at the time had an enormous lopsided mustache, hair down to his, halfway down his back, and he's walking around with people like Ted Rogers. Went in to meet Ted. I wish I had been there.
Yeah, LG.
So, yeah.
1983
was the next change.
Talent scouts from CKNW came out and asked me if I wanted to do the morning show at CFMI. Now, I'd been going through some hard times at LG by this time, because for one reason or another, and I suspect it was their national program director, I was getting pressured to do a lot of things. It was, and it came down to, Gary Bynow was the program director. And we had a meeting at my house, and he said something to me to the effect of, if you don't like it, you don't have to come in on Monday. I cannot tolerate being threatened. I will not take that. So, but the other thing is I'm passive-aggressive. So I just sort of put it in the file. I went, well, one of these mornings, I won't come in. So CFMI wooed me, and we hit it. We made a deal, and I actually resigned on Christmas Eve. And Alden Deal had to drive all the way in from Tawasin to write my last check, which I'm sure really pleased him on Christmas Eve. It's like, so I went over to CFMI.
What were you doing at CFMI?
Mornings.
Yep. And what they started up for a week is country, I think, when they first went on the air.
Yeah, that's right.
Then
exactly.
They switched over.
They were what you'd call adult pop. They, as a matter of fact, they had billboards with pop bottles on them at one point. They said adult pop. I replaced Robert O. Smith on mornings.
Mm-hmm.
Bob went to evenings. I got about twice what he did. It's okay to say that now because sadly he's gone.
He's left us, yes.
What a great guy he was. Bob, man, just in tribute to him, there was a man with such enormous talent that nobody could direct, not even him. He's like J.B. Shane in that regard.
Bouncing off the walls all
the
time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Just this brain going all the time. And it's like, I understood him because I can think that way. But I'm sure there were a lot of people looking at the radios going, what? Huh? But what a great guy, and what a talent, and what a nice person. Bob always had something. He was like Al Jordan. Always had something nice to say to you, and he always kept up with what you were doing, too. When I started my podcast, one of the first complimentary emails I got on it was from Bob, and he thought it was the best podcast he'd ever heard. And I know why that was, because it was the kind of podcast he would do.
CFMI.
Yeah. No, we're not done with CFMI yet, though.
Oh, we're not?
Couple
of years there, so yeah. Some interesting CFMI stories.
Yeah. Had a great time working there. Tim Birch was the program director. And Tim, at the time, as he was at the time, was a very angry man, probably influenced to some degree by products that had come from...
Mr. Tanner mentioned...
The Bolivian chit-chat flakes figured in Tim's psyche at the time, which made him a bit cranky, which was okay because I understood Tim, you know, and it's like, and I knew what the problem was, so that was part of the thing. I knew how to approach him. But at some point, they brought in a consultant. Ain't that always the way? John Sebastian came in, not the one from the Love and Spoonful, folks, the radio one. And he came in and did a thing he called, I think it was AOR, he called it album-oriented rock, something like that. But basically, he played album tracks that went deep. And there was a lot fewer breaks, and they swept for longer chunks of music, even on the morning show. And so, but you know, I said, sure, I'll play along. You know, this is fun. This is great. But then, after a couple of weeks of trying this out, Sebastian declared that I was too zany. There is nothing worse than being charged with being too zany. So I cut it back. I just cut it back. And basically, I was reading the weather twice an hour. Easy money, Mike. It's like, but what happened was that because I had all this spare time, my guitar chops got really good. I was able to practice guitar 7 hours a day. I didn't have to do any show prep. I didn't have to do any production for the show. So I just sat in my studio at home and played the guitar.
Sounds like a precursor of today's radio.
Yes, it was, as a matter of fact, it was, yeah. But then, here's where it gets really good. They decided that it wasn't working. So Tim comes to me quietly and says, we're going to pull the format. We're going back to what we were doing before. And he says, and you can go back to what you were doing before. I said, okay, listen, I'll tell you what. Just let me do anything I want. I said, I don't want to hear from you. I don't want memos. I don't want meetings. I don't even want a raised eyebrow or a cursory glance as I walked down the hallway. And he said, fine, that's great. So I went ahead and did that, and the numbers tripled. But then Ted Smith, who was the general manager, left to go downtown to work for WIC. And in his place came the sales manager, Ron Bremner. Now, Ron and I had never really seen eye to eye. He didn't like me at all. And something interesting had been happening. Dave McCormick had left. Dave had been doing Discumentary. And to substitute for him, because he had left and gone to, I think, JR Country, they brought in Terry David Mulligan to do the show. And Mulligan spent part of every day he was in there chatting up Bremner. Now, I'd learned to keep an eye on Mulligan before, because he had, it was reported to me, every time I went on vacation at LG, he'd be in the program director's office telling the program director why he should be doing the morning show. Well, lo and behold, they bring in Don Schaefer as the program director, and one of his first duties is to fire me and put Mulligan on the morning show. Now, every time this happens, Mulligan did get the morning show at LG after I left, and he lasted a year. He got the morning show at CFMI. He lasted a year. They still hadn't learned.
The old climb the ladder with the daggers, right?
Yeah. I'll tell you what's even weirder. It's like, this guy was stalking me, man. It's like, later on I had a TV show called Rockin' Talk, which became Rockin' Doc because a TV station in Windsor had a show by the same name. But after, I went on vacation, went off to Europe, and I came back a couple months later, Mulligan had my TV show, which became Good Rockin' Tonight. Isn't that weird? It's like, I was the first one on CBC to be showing videos. But that doesn't count for anything. Because, well, once again, it's the people you're standing beside when the grenade goes off. Ken Gibson, who was in charge at CBC, did not like my producer and director, Jeff Groberman. And so when he came in as, he was promoted to director of TV or whatever. So he, the first thing he did was get rid of Groberman. And by association, because I was standing beside him and the pin fell out of the grenade, me. So I was out of there. And guess who gets the show? Mulligan! Anyway, let's see. We're just finishing off CFMI, aren't
yep.
we?
Yep. Now, was that your decision or their decision again?
It was their decision. Yes. Don Schaefer took me into his office and fired me and later told me it was the hardest thing he ever had to do. Okay, Don.
I love that.
I think they have the little book with lines to say when you're getting dumping somebody.
That's right, exactly. Yeah. You just don't fit in.
What?
No, it's insane. But it's like, it don't matter because it comes down to, you know, I believe, especially in this business, that 90% of the firings are because of personality clashes. Well, now it's because of money. But back in the day.
Yeah, don't ask for more than $12 an hour.
Oh, yeah, and as soon as you hit 35,000, you're out.
We've seen that over the last year and a half.
Absolutely.
Locally.
I've been a victim of it a couple of times.
I think we all have.
Yeah.
You're too expensive. Yeah. We can get somebody cheaper.
This is the problem.
Not better, but cheaper.
Well, that's right. But, I mean, who are you working for? Hey, or as Chuck Cameron used to say, this is a business, not a club.
Alan Waters used to call it a family.
Yeah, well, it wasn't a club, apparently. It was a business.
Yes.
It's a business. That's warm-hearted. Good luck to you. So, there I am, out at CFMI.
Now we're at 1986.
That's correct. Expo was on. I had left CFMI, the affiliate of CKNW. CKNW was heavily involved in Expo 86, and I had gotten a free pass from them. These were plastic laminated passes, and they had to be renewed on a monthly basis with a new colored sticker. Who would mail me a new sticker every month so I could continue to attend Expo 86, which I thought was awfully sweet. I'll say who she is. Time has passed. She's Tom Plasteris' wife now.
Okay.
Now they'll get divorced. No, that's not true.
So 1986, we're off to CKKS-FM.
KISS-FM,
which
that's right.
Is now...
That's Jack.
And at that time, they were playing...
Soft rock. So that wasn't my first choice. I went over to CFOX first. Schaefer had just left. And the guy who was in charge had a meeting with me and told me that what I did didn't work anymore. Which is funny because this particular guy, who shall remain nameless, shortly after left radio and has worked for the provincial government ever since. So apparently what he did didn't work anymore either. But I tried out a number of different things. I mean, it's like I was supposed to be teamed with Bob Say. And I love Bob. We had a couple of lunches together, but they really didn't click together too well. And eventually this guy told me that I wouldn't fit in there, so I'm casting about trying to figure out what to do. Because my wife is in Saudi Arabia, and they would probably disapprove, if you knew her, you'd know what I was talking about, if she came back and found me jobless. So went to Kiss FM, and I forget exactly why. I had a sit down with Marty Forbes. He joined me and Tom Peacock over at Tom's favorite restaurant across the road there from WX. And we sat and had lunch. Then we drank some more lunch. And at one point, Tom went off to the bathroom. And I said to Marty, "What does he want me to say?" And he says, "He wants you to say that you're in it for the long term." And I'm thinking, well, I spent 10 years at LG. I think that's a clue. I would have spent another 10 years at CFMI if they let me. But anyway, so Tom comes back and sits down and says, "You know, Tom, I want to be in this for the long term." And we made a deal. It was great. They made me cut an extremely elaborate demo in my studio, but it's like, it was enough to get me the job. That was kind of a thrill for me, and I'll tell you why. There's a number of things that you set out probably as unconscious goals when you first start out in the business. I was able to work at 1275 Burrard, which was where CKWX had moved in 1957. This beautiful building with mosaic tile on the outside and the inside. The stinkiest shower I've ever run into. They had a shower in the building that it was made completely of mildew. But this was where Red Robinson had worked. This is where, and I mean, I grew up listening to Red. I started, you see, in my family, Mike, we never had a TV. We didn't have a TV till I was about 13 years old. So we had radio. And I might be the director of a network by now, if not for that simple twist of fate. But just listening to the radio, and I discovered Red when, before Red came along, I was listening, "Oh, baby mine," listening to these old Patti Page things, old Cape Cod, stuff like this. And then Red came along, and it was like a revelation on CJOR. Now, I hooked into him simply because, as a little kid, at noon hour every day, the family would listen to Kitty's Carnival on CJOR. It was hosted by a guy named Ross Mortimer. And Ross, when I was 5 years old, came out to the Sunset Memorial Kindergarten up between Main and Fraser on 52nd, I think, did the show live from there. And they brought one of these old Ampex 350s and set it up and recorded the kids. And you could yell things and they'd play them back to you. Well, that sold me. Started being in love with the sound of my own voice.
That's how
time.
You got hooked.
Absolutely. But we always listened to CJOR, and it happened, the radio happened to be left on, and in the afternoon, on came this kid playing rock and roll. And it changed my life. Because back in those days, this was just before they got cart machines. So everything was on these transcriptions, 12-inch transcriptions.
The Coke commercials, everything.
Yeah, everything was on disc. And so like he's queuing up stuff like mad and answering phones and filling out the log. Oh, you needed that third one for a backup. I didn't get in the business so late that we didn't need turntables. Yeah. Three was always it. If you had two, you felt kind of scared.
And when carts came in, that was a luxury because they were so easy to use. No more queuing records.
The beauty part, Mike, was when they first introduced carts, and I guess this is about 1962, a Cephon, they hadn't figured out, I guess, how to put the tertiary tone on them, so they would just keep playing. They had other stuff on Cephon that was really cool, too, which was like a news monkey for the news item. Saigon. Around about that time, too, I mean, this is, I'll get back to Kiss in a minute, but around about that time, too, the other thing I discovered was KJR in Seattle, which was like a miracle. KJR was everything Cephon was, but even better, because essentially Cephon was a clone of KJR. They had the same jingles and everything, but they had an air staff that was absolutely amazing. Pat O'Day in the afternoon, Dick Curtis at night. They had Lan Roberts. Jockey John Stone was this guy that deserves a book to be written about him because he was one of the craziest people on earth. He was completely mad. But they had just the best people. And it's like I idolized people like Pat and Lan and Jerry Kay. Because they would just do crazy shit. And one of my favorite things I was telling Red about this. One of my favorite things that Jerry ever did was, remember that song by Noel Harrison called A Young Girl?
Yes.
Sing the last line of it here so you'll know what he did. A young girl of 16. Well, I thought I was going to sing, but that's not singing. Lying there by the road, dead. And then Jerry plays a laugh track.
pack was what made it so good.
Because he didn't care.
Yeah.
He used to read live copy, too. And he goes, you'll like Dag's. There's a place called Dag's Beefy Boys down in Seattle. I think Dag's is still open. And he said, you'll like Dag's Beefy Boys because they're made from real boys. And of course, Larry Lujack. All these guys work at KJR. Tom Murphy.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant. Of course, Lujack and Jerry went to WLS in Chicago, which is pretty good compliment to them, and Murphy went to WCFL in Chicago. Just amazing talents. Other people who were on the station at the time were Lee Perkins, but one of the guys they had on KJR, and a lot of people don't remember this, was Morton Downey Jr. as Doc Downey. He only lasted about 6 months, as he did everywhere he worked, but he was one of the best DJs I've ever heard. He had something for every set. And really short bits. That was the other thing. And they just went bam, bam, and that was it. You know, but he could set up anything. And it's like, it was just brilliant, man. It was absolutely amazing. I mean, it's like, I probably learned my bad habits from KJR. I remember one time Rudy Hartman, who was the program director at CFMS, for where I got fired for not towing the line, apparently met my mom one time and said to her, should tell your son not everything is funny. And so she passes this along to me, and I said, well, if you see Rudy again, you tell him I think he's funny. But KJR was like a major influence on me. I mean, I've never heard anything like that. Pat O'Day, now there's a guy who had an ability to choose talent because he had people who were just monsters. A guy who was absolutely amazing, Les Crane.
Yes.
Les Crane on KGO. Les had a show he did from The Hungry Eye, and every radio freak in Vancouver used to listen to it in the early 60s because the signal just boomed in here at night. And Les, I found out later, during the time he was doing this and handling all these calls in a very witty manner, and he had great guests because all the comedians and musicians who played at The Hungry Eye would come into the back room wherever they had KGO set up. And he would interview them. Jonathan Winters was absolutely amazing. And so Shelley Berman, people like that.
Zany people.
Oh, yeah, just great people. But he could handle these calls just so beautifully, hanging up on people and telling them to shut up. I found out later when he was doing it, he was 24 years old. What a talent. Now, he had been previously the program director at KYA, a rock and roll station, and he did the morning show as well as being program director as Johnny Raven. He actually was Les Stein, but he was Les Crane. Once again, it's the thing about reaching your level of incompetence. He was absolutely brilliant on the radio. ABC thought he was so good that they gave him a TV show. And he was the first guy, he did this before Donahue, anybody, to go out in the audience with his shotgun mic. He had this Sennheiser shotgun mic he would use and talk to people in the audience. And the whole thing just stiffed. And we didn't hear from him again until he did Desiderata, the million-selling punk record. He started he's a very bright guy. He started a software company after that. The money from the record to start a software company. And was doing that up until he died last year.
Great names, great memories. We're getting off the track, though. We're supposed to be talking about Doc Harris.
We're Kiss. And I'm there. And I did have a few conflicts with Marty Forbes during the time I was there. They tried a number of different things. They put Julie Brown in with me as a sidekick. And that was when I first learned I don't work well with sidekicks. I don't know because it's I'm Mike Hogg or what. Or basically because maybe the sidekick doesn't really have a function. They put me in. And what happened with me and Julie was we had a very natural relationship in the sense that we bickered on the air. It's like people would call the program director and say, it sounds like a couple is breaking up. Just, there was this edge, there was this certain unenjoyable tension in the show. So that didn't work out. And the ratings kind of stayed kind of flat. I mean, it's like we did okay, but we weren't killer. And I like to ascribe that to the radio station, not the talent, as I often do when that happens. But what happened there was we ran into a few obstacles. Marty and I did not hit it off. On one occasion, he had me into his office, and he pulls out this letter that's been written on lined paper in a very scrawly fashion and reads it to me, and a woman who was going through a car wash at the time has just heard a promo, not the show, but a promo I cut for the show, and calls me a lowlife, among other things. And Marty sets the thing down on his desk and says, and you know, I agree with all of it. It's not that Marty's a bad guy, but he says stupid things. And that was one of them. And so it's like I was going on vacation the following Monday. Yeah, so this was on a, I think this was on a Thursday. And I said, I'm going on vacation on Monday, and I might not come back. Not much of a reaction at all. I was okay with him.
So was that the end?
No. I came back, and I was there for quite a while. As a matter of fact, Marty left before I did. Marty left to go to Toronto and CKFM. So they were looking for a program director. I suggested Dale Biot. I had worked with Dale over at CFMI when he was music director and probably saved his job a couple of times because Ted Smith would come to me and say, every time I go past Dale's office, he's in there reading a magazine. I said, well, you know, it's probably Billboard or something. He's probably working on the station. I doubt very much he's just reading a magazine. Anyway, so when they needed a program director, I thought Dale would be a good guy for it. And as it turned out, he was. The best time I had while I was working at KISS was when Dale was the PD, because he had sort of a let-it-go attitude, and he had some good people working for him, and it worked fine. And it all went along fine until one morning, I see him after the show, and he says, I heard your whole show this morning, yeah? I didn't hear one funny thing. And I said, well, I think that says more about you than it does about me. But it still upset me. Because here I am working with another guy who will say stupid things. Because that's just a stupid thing to say. And Dale, to his credit, apologized for it later on. Says, maybe I was a little harsh. Maybe you got
up on the wrong side of the bed.
And took it out on me. Yeah, thanks a lot. But it's like, we had a pretty good time at KISS. It was never a success. It never really went over. I don't know what the problem was. Maybe it wasn't promoted enough, maybe it wasn't tightly formatted enough, maybe we didn't project enough of an image, maybe it's just the word soft rock, because that always struck me as being kind of badly in need of Cialis. I don't know if that's fair at all. Anyway, what happened was, exciting times, because we were building a new building up on Ash Street, and moving out of 1275 Burrard. And goodbye 1275 Burrard, but what a great place that was.
That was a beautiful building. Oh, I love that radio station.
Oh, not only that, man, it was where everything happened. It's where Red had Little Richard at the piano in Studio A. It's where they reconstructed the Vancouver Mounties baseball games with Jim Ropps and Ron Robinson and Bill Stevenson. It's like, oh, God, yeah. I mean, it's like that's so much a part of the history, because it's like, I used to listen to them on my crystal set. They were 50,000 watts. They were the only thing you could get. They drowned out everything else. I mean, but I had to leave. So move along to 2440 Ash. And we had a dedicated building, which had been designed by James Chang, who is now, his latest thing is the Shangri-La.
Yeah.
He got big time. I actually lived in one of his townhouses. This guy has always been a genius architect. This townhouse, you know how townhouses usually have a window at the front and it's all dark in the back? Chang had come up with the idea of putting a skylight at the back and then a light well all the way down three floors. And it changed the whole place. But I mean, just a small innovation like this, this guy is brilliant. If you need an architect and you have a few billion dollars, call James Chang. Chang designed the building for us. And here's one thing that's tragic. There's a giant atrium in there when you first go into the building. And it was supposed to be a museum of all the old gear from CKWX in the early days. And unfortunately, they ran out of room and turned it into offices and stuff. So it's like, but I understand now somebody is starting a proper radio museum.
In Toronto, yes. Yeah. It's hopefully going to be in the CBC building. They're negotiating on space for it now. Right now, they're located in the old All-Canada building, 1000 Yonge Street.
Yeah.
This is being done primarily by Bob and Doug, not the Bob and Doug you remember from television, but Bob Lane, lifetime chum employee and retired
Hello
at the top
world.
Of
this
the food.
This is Bobo.
Yep, retired at the top of the food chain there. And Doug Thompson, longtime production genius.
I did spots for Doug the whole time I was in Toronto.
They are spearheading it. Red is involved. Cool. A lot of people are involved in this. There are going to be anything we can find, equipment, recordings,
people,
documentation, pictures. Well, maybe we'll have some people stuffed and
have
mounted.
Them stuffed. That would be lovely.
That would be good.
Just like
anyway,
Trigger.
This is in the formative stages.
These interviews
are going to live there as well.
Oh, really? Okay.
So all of this is coming together. I think we're the only country in the civilized world that doesn't have a proper broadcast museum.
I think you mentioned that. And for folks who don't know, Mike shows up on every radio chat page in the world.
North America.
Well, I certainly see your name show up a lot. For example, in Southwest Ontario, what is it?
You're Southern Ontario, Ontario, you're on the, you're Western on, New York.
You're on Radio West, and you're on the Puget Sound Radio. Puget Sound Radio, this is interesting, you know. Guy Sam, who runs it, Mike Easton, he and I worked together at CFMS back in the day.
Yeah.
He was one of the people who was working there at the time, helped me get in there.
Yeah, he's a long West Coast history as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, okay, KISS, we moved to the new building, and one of the first things that happens is, well, okay, I'll tell you what happened just before this. We were offered stock options as Selkirk owned the company, and they would do a thing where you could buy stock options. If you wanted $10,000 worth of stock, you only had to put down $1,000 because it was 10%, and you paid it out in monthly increments. What happened was, I bought some stock. I bought it at $24. Then about 3 weeks later, Rogers bought the company. Stock went to $48. And then Rogers came in. And then Chuck McCoy was the new general manager. And on his first day, 9 o'clock in the morning, he fired me. He gave me a very generous payout, and of course I had the stock. So I didn't work again for about 8 months.
What was the reason for the firing? Another personality conflict from years gone by, or?
Partly, yeah. I can tell you, actually, I have a theory about this. When I was doing mornings at LG, he was up against this with C-Fund. Now, this is probably just my own ego talking, but the fact is that we beat everybody they put on the morning show. It's like, it didn't matter who was on the C-Fund morning show, we beat them. They put Jim Holt on, they had Latrimo on, they had everybody that could come up, but they even had Pat St. John on. And it's like, they just couldn't beat us at all. And it ended with poor old Chuck having to leave the company. And I can't help but think I was partly blamed for that. I mean, I know I would blame him if he did it to me. So when he saw me at the radio station, I guess he didn't want to. Also, and this is another large factor, he wanted very much to hire Fred Latrimo to do the morning show at KISS. As it turned out, Fred did not come over immediately. And part of the reason I was told, and I don't know if this is true, call me, Fred, tell me, was because of the way I got blown out. So he had to put Terry Reid on the morning show, and Terry did a good job. Terry's a great workman. I mean, he's just, you know, one of the funniest guys you'll ever meet, and he never does it on the air. It's one of the weirdest things. But anyway, I'm fired out of there.
Yeah.
So I don't work for about 7-8 months. During that time, I bought my first real computer. I bought a 286. Before that, I had a TRS-80, right? One of those Radio Shack ones. And it's like, which essentially is good for typing things. This was an actual computer. So you do graphics programs. And basically, I learned how to use a computer. And so it's like, I spent 7 or 8 months doing that. I was sort of casting about for something to do by this point because I was beginning to run out of the money. I got a call. No, I called John Mackey, who was at 1040 Kix, as it was at the time. Well, it's CKXY, it was 1040 Kix.
Didn't last very long at those number letters.
No, as a matter of fact, it changed, I think. It changed twice while I was there. I'm not joking, it actually did. But anyway, yeah, Mackey. And he nearly died because he thought, well, he had heard I was dead. And I called him up, and I guess he soiled his chair. He told me that they didn't really have anything at this time. They had Stu Jeffries on the morning show. He had a whole bunch of things going on, and frankly, I'd heard him, and he wasn't doing that well. So I said, I'd be very interested in doing your morning show. Well, nothing came of it. Mackey left shortly thereafter, and then Dave Calder, the new general manager, called me up and said, we'd like to hire you for our morning show. So I did the thing that I always do, which is I wrote up a contract. And I always write out these contracts that are very simple. It's just, you will pay this guy this much money for this length of time. Sign here. And, of course, that always starts the negotiation. Well, in this case, and it had an outrageous amount of money on it because you got to negotiate, right? Yeah. In this case, Dave looks at it and goes, sure, that's good. I'm thinking, wow, this is going to be good. It's like, and sure enough, the funny part was, they were still in a fiscal year where they had been paying Stu $45,000, which was a good deal less than what I was asking. But they had this fiscal setup where they couldn't pay me anything but $45,000 until the end of the fiscal year. Then I would be paid off the full amount prorated. Well, come the end of the fiscal year, the money was insane. Because you understand, I built up all this credit. And it's like all of a sudden they're scooping it out at me.
Yes.
Kix was an interesting thing because, once again, we had a great staff. We had some wonderful people working there. Paul McKnight was the program director, and we had a whole bunch of really good people on staff. Put it that way. Kim Seal was working with me in the morning, and she's absolutely brilliant.
She's a fabulous woman.
Greatest women I've ever met, and just so much fun and so nice, and will play along with anything. She's very malleable. And there's actually an air check on Radio West of me and her doing the morning show, and I hadn't realized how good she was. I'd forgotten. And she's just brilliant. She's right in there to fill the gaps but not get in the way. It doesn't become a mic fight. So, okay. Let's see, we're there. And what happened with that was kind of tragic because they ran out of money. It came to the point where my contract ran out. And they started paying. I said, well, first of all, they were 1040 Kix when I first got there. Then they became, I forget what it was, a Rock 1040. And that was album tracks. And they got that through a focus group. Don't ever go to focus groups. Focus groups just tell you what you want to hear. Apparently they went in with the idea they'd like to do album tracks. And the guy said, Yeah, sure. Well, that's what the group says, because you can manipulate them. Anyway, did that, and then we went to CIMA, changed the color, and became Magic 104, which was based on what they were doing at KFRC in San Francisco. We got screwed on that one because Paul McKnight foolishly told Neil Gallagher, who was working for Chum and QM, was switching over at the time, that was what he was going to do. And so immediately Gallagher went out and hired Bill Ham to supply the music of your life, same format as the Magic one, and got it on the air before we did. And so we were scrawed. And I actually think that we had a much better presentation than they did, but it didn't make any difference because they already had a profile in the community. And so that was part of the problem there. Anyway, what happened was they stopped putting money into the radio station, and it was like watching something die. The idea was we could keep all the money we made, but we weren't going to be propped up by head office. So there we were with the carpet slowly curling up and equipment breaking down and stuff getting dirty. And it's just basically they let it run in the ground, and eventually it went dark. It just died. It went off the air. And we all know about the reincarnations and talk to other people about that, but it was gone. But I'm over at the hearings for them changing format or what they're going to do. And I run into Michael Campbell, the Premier's brother. And he says, you know, Ted Smith doesn't like the fill-in guy he's got for Frosty right now. You should give him a call. And so I called up Ted, because I knew Ted from CFMI days. And he says, yeah, call Doug Rutherford, tell him that you want the job, and that if he doesn't fire the guy he's got on there right now, I'll fire him. So I called up Rutherford, and I said, well, here's the deal. Anyway, that was great, because CKNW, for God's sake, that's the pinnacle. And actually, I went in there with a plan, which was that when Frosty retired, I would get the morning show. This, as we all know, did not work out. But it was still great to be there because that is the best. I worked with all the best people. Worked with, oh man, just everybody. Rick Honey, Frosty, all the talk show hosts. Bannerman was there at the time. Bill Good, Cullen. I mean, wow. Just amazing. The whole thing being that I did the fill-in. There was a lot more fill-in then. I was filling in for both Rick and Frosty. And on one occasion, both of them were away at the same time. So I did the morning show, and then I came back and did the afternoon drive. And John Ashbridge puts a sign in the window as I'm sitting there. And says, CKNW, all dark, all the time. I was there, but now, unfortunately, because I'd been so excited to get on to NW, I hadn't negotiated very hard. And I was making peanuts, Mike. I mean, serious peanuts. And it's like, I got an offer from Seafunk to go over to do their show, because by now, Fred had left to go over to Kiss. Okay. And so I talked to them after a bit of stupidity. And she said, we'd like to, could you do one of your shifts on NW the way you would do the morning show on Seafunk? I said, NW is not your demo room. I can't do that. You know what I've been in the market now for 30 years. I don't know what I sound like. Anyway, got the job. Now, sadly, they gave me a sidekick, Jaylene LaRose. Jaylene's a sweet lady, but unfortunately does not have the type of acuity that I need to be able to work with her. And I began, along with Neil Gallagher, the program director, making plans to get rid of her. And so we auditioned a whole mess of people and finally found a new sidekick, if I had to have one, who actually inspired me greatly because she really had great ideas and was really good at coming up with stuff and egging me on. Her name is Taylor Houston, and I'd worked with her briefly when I was doing the backstage announcer voice for a show out at BCTV called Talk About, and she was one of the writers for the show. And she also knew Groverman, and I had worked with her on the Dr. Mandola TV show. But it's like, we hired her. And that went along just fine for a couple of months. And then, she all of a sudden, one day, we're out having some lunch, and she says something about, I don't want to work at your house anymore, because she'd been coming over after the show, and we'd do stuff in my studio for the next day. I don't want to work at your house anymore. I said, well, why is that? I just don't want to. And I said, okay. I don't know why you're doing this, but we better have a talk with the program director about it. Well, I come in on the Monday. This was on a Friday, and on Monday, I come in, and Gallagher has a letter from her indicating that while she was over at my house, I had jumped on her, forced her down on the bed, and tried to kiss her. Well, Mike, I would never do that type of thing. I'm not the kind of guy who jumps on women. And I was trying to figure out for a while why she had done this. Well, it turns out, at some point, I hear from my spies in their newsroom that she got a phone call from Jaylene LaRose. And after that, was absolutely terrified of me. Now, I don't know what Jaylene said to her, but the upshot of the whole thing was, we both got fired. And about a month after we both got fired, I went back to NW the same day I got fired. I called up Rod Gunn, who by now was the general manager, and he said, sure, come on back. It was just like that. But about a month after that, I get a letter from the Canadian Human Rights Commission demanding $1,000 for the hurt feelings of Taylor Houston. And my attitude was, screw that. I'm not going to pay this. I didn't do anything. So it ended up that I spent 3 years with the Human Rights Commission, boring into every aspect of my life, and wasting a lot of money because, and here's something important to know. Even if you win a case with the Human Rights Commission, you do not get your costs back. I spent $20,000 on that, and I think it was money well spent, and I don't regret it, but I still didn't get it back. And the tribunal found that she was a liar. They said it in so many words. And obviously she was, because none of this stuff ever happened. But I still got screwed on the money thing. And it's like, also, my reputation was tarnished. I also learned some things about the media during this time. In the early part of the tribunal, when the prosecution was producing their witnesses, the Vancouver Sun paid rapt attention to this and reported on it every day. As soon as my witnesses took the stand, 17 different women and a couple of guys who were happy to testify they'd worked closely with me on many projects and had never been bothered by me at all, they stopped reporting. They didn't bother covering it. And they didn't cover it again until I was
exonerated.
Yeah, exonerated, yeah. Absolutely amazing. But yeah. I learned a lot about the media during that time. So I'm back at NW, and I'm filling in, and I'm doing all that stuff. And some interesting things always happen. Frosty, you know, we get these migraines, and I'd have to go in at 4 o'clock. You know, they call me at 4 o'clock in the morning to tell me. And sometimes I'd be doing things at 4 o'clock in the morning. They probably weren't compatible with filling in on the morning show, but I remember one particular morning when I was enjoying some brown wine from Scotland with a lady friend of mine, and it's 4 o'clock and the phone rings. Now, we had most of a bottle of brown wine, and I get a phone call, and it says, can you come in? Frosty's got one of his headaches. Oh, good. So I'm hanging off the spigot in the shower, trying to remain upright long enough, and I actually put on a suit for the thing to go in. And I check my look in the mirror, and I'm going, you know, I look pretty good. I think I can do this. Hey, drive somewhat unsteadily down to the radio station. And I go in, and I'm all, by now I've pulled myself together pretty good. And I give all the appearance of sobriety. And I walk in, and the all-night op says, you smell like a distillery. So apparently I had the look, but not the aroma. Ah. Anyway, wonderful times at NW. Some of the best stuff I've ever done. Did remotes every weekend and did the fill-in stuff. The end of the thing was just after 9/11. As a matter of fact, It happened on a particularly propitious date, because I remember what I said to Tom Plasteris when they fired me. First George Harrison dies, and now this. It was the same day. But, so I was out of there. Well, I don't think I've given enough time to NW. One of the things I ended up doing before I left there was a Saturday morning talk show. For reasons best known to God, it had the highest ratings on the station. I had a 23 share. Now, I admit, on Saturday mornings, you don't have a lot of competition, but it's a 23 share. Yep. I mean, it was outrageous.
Massive.
And that was weird to me, because it's like, what happened was that the next thing that happened, Tom fires me. I mean, it's like, wouldn't you think that a guy who's getting a 23 share, you might want to try out somewhere else in the broadcast day? Anyway, I don't know. I don't know why these people do this. But I got to work with the greatest people. And I'll tell you, one of the coolest things was that occasionally when I'd be filling in for Frosty, I get a phone call on the hotline, and this voice would go, "Kid, you're doing a great job." It would be Cullen. And it's like, you know, Red thinks I did a great job. Cullen thinks I did a great job. Pat O'Day thinks I did a great job. And that's really all I need. I don't care. I don't have to seek approval from anyone else.
The top people respect you. That's all you need.
Yeah, these are the people that I admire the most, you know? Anyway, yeah, so I'm out of there. And then I go to Sea Isle after a certain amount of time, doing some weekend stuff. Just essentially doing my best of Doc Harris on the weekend. And that was parlayed into doing the morning show. Jerry O'Day decided he would move himself to afternoon. I moved. No, that's not right. I'm lying. It was Tom Lucas. They moved Tom out. I remember what happened. Okay, yeah. It was Gary Russell's idea. And Gary moved me into the morning show, moved Tom out. And Jerry was still on in the afternoon. Anyway, I went for about a year there. And this was one of the times I was fired because they were out of money. Essentially, they didn't want to spend any more money. Prior to my leaving on this occasion, Jerry and I were actually doing the entire broadcast day on voice track on some occasions because they couldn't afford to pay anyone else to do it. We were the only two that were on salary. The rest were part-timers, and they couldn't afford it. So it ended up that I got bounced out. Now, I had a deal going with Gary where if I increased the ratings by a certain number of points, I would get a $10,000 bonus. And a week before the ratings came out, they fired me. Now, when the ratings did come out a week later, I didn't have access to the book, so I talked to Red, and I said, "Red, can you check the book and find out how I did? I just want to know, because I got a bonus writing on this, as far as I'm concerned." I had to increase the morning numbers by 58%. Not bad.
Not bad.
And a bad time to fire somebody. And God bless Gary, he gave me the $10,000 bonus. I got the money, so he's a straight shooter, that man. Then a couple of years went by, during which time I did a whole bunch of different stuff, including the podcast and all that, and I was hired back by Xia and did Afternoon Drive on this occasion. And that was the first time I had worked for years without an operator. I ran my own board, and that became part of the show, because I would regularly break the radio station. Busted the radio station again. It's like stuff would go off wrong. You see, the reason I had an operator, Mike, is I'm physically a boob.
You're all thumbs.
Well, and elbows. It's like nothing goes right. It's just a nightmare. But it's like, yeah, it became part of the bit. But, yeah, so I did this, and I don't think I'm suited for Afternoon Drive quite. I didn't really have an impact in the afternoon. I mean, it's like it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. And at this point, I discovered a really weird thing was happening, whereby I was coming up with stuff I hadn't thought of. It would just come out of my mouth. And it's like, I thought for a while that I was being guided by voices or having some kind of a Philip K. Dick experience. But in fact, what I figured out later was that this, I was explaining this to Roy Hennessy. I said, it's kind of like when a musician, a songwriter will tell you, they don't know where it comes from, it's just there, you know? And it's like, it was the same thing. I come up with this stuff, and wow, did I say that? That was brilliant. That was just amazing. If I must say so myself. No, and I figured out what it was, where it was coming from. All these years of carefully writing stuff down and, you know, working stuff out had composted and turned into this rich, dark loam. And that was my rich, dark loam on the radio. But I got fired anyway. Got to sort of a, well, they changed formats. And got prior to that, I'd had a bit of a disagreement with the general manager because he felt I should be warmer and fuzzier than I was. Well, I'm not, yeah, exactly, because that's one way you can get to me, because, you see, I can't do warm and fuzzy. It comes off as insincere. As I'm putting it mildly, is I'm not warm, nor am I fuzzy. So, and also, this was great. You don't fit in with the new format. As you know, AM 650 is now playing, you know, like standards and things like that.
Which you started playing back in 1960, whatever.
63. Yeah, you're following me here. Yeah, and of course, I did 10 years of it at NW.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's right, I don't fit in. And I'm sitting there thinking, this could be the best unjust dismissal suit ever. And then I thought, nah, this isn't such a bad guy. I don't know why I'm letting him off the hook, but I will. And so I didn't pursue it.
So that was it for organized radio programs.
That's right.
And Doc, of course, is still around. We still hear Doc. You do commercials.
Yep.
You've got your podcast.
Podcast is in limbo at the moment, but it probably will come back.
But you have a bunch of things going on. We still hear your voice.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
I always like to end these things with, what was Doc's favorite moment in his career? And this is always a hard one.
Yeah, there's always a bunch of them, you know? It's like becoming a friend of those guys from KJR was one. Working at CFTR when George Johns was in charge of it, and we had all those great people. LG during its golden era when we had a larger cum than NW. Working at NW itself with all those stars. Working in those buildings. The C-Fund, I worked in the original C-Fund building before they moved to 2nd Avenue. I mean, I used to go down there and hang around. You know, it's like, and of course, becoming friends with all these famous people like Red. I mean, I used to listen to Red when I was a kid. I never thought he'd be a friend of mine. I used to go and bug him when I was in junior high school, you know. And he'd give me and Tommy these really bad 45s that they weren't going to play. But hey, I mean, it's just been a great ride, man. I got to do pretty much everything I wanted to do, except I've still got more in me. I haven't pitched a perfect game yet.
Finally, favorite person that you've met, if you can pick out
one. Oh, that's hard to tell. Favorite people, I mean, Red, obviously. Cullen was one because he was just his own man for his whole life. Never once deviated. I'll tell you a quick story here about this thing. The guys in the NW newsroom one night are listening to the police radio, and there's some kind of a large American car barreling down McBride at high speed, and they don't know what's in it, but the driver seems to be impaired. And something pulls up in the parking lot, opens the back door, and comes into the men's room, and then goes back out again. And it's like, they go into the bathroom, it's like it was somebody who couldn't aim. And it's like, and they had weed all over the place. And as they look out the door, it's Cullen's car pulling off into the darkness. Jack was brilliant. Jack was one of a kind. But it's like, Fred Latrimo, I haven't said enough about him. What a brilliant guy. What a great guy. What a funny man. And what a fine mind. I mean, it's endless. George Johns, one of the best program directors and creative minds in the business. Chuck Christian, who worked with us at CFTR in Toronto. I don't know what Chuck's a marijuana advocate now, but it's like at the time, he was the fastest, quickest, most... This is where I learned how to edit, because it's like this guy could get off the entire guts of a joke in 5 seconds and it would make sense. You know, it's like, just so many talented people. Rick Moranis. I mean, it's like the list goes on and on.
Doc Harris, your friends in the business were right. You have to talk to Doc Harris. He's got great stories. Thanks for this.
You're very welcome, Mike. And it's a real pleasure because I've been listening to these interviews and I think they're great. Keep up the good work.